Hello, North Texas sports fans.
Welcome to Sports Day Insider from the Dallas Morning News.
It's your weekly update on all things Cowboys, Rangers, Mavericks, Stars. Should I go on?
I'm Kevin Sherrington.
I'm Evan Grant.
And I'm David Moore.
We break down the calls, the playmakers, and all the inside scoop right here every Tuesday.
And you can stay up to date on every Sports Day Insider episode and other great shows. Just follow the Dallas Morning News wherever you get your podcast.
And if you like what you hear, don't forget to rate the Dallas Morning News feed. It really does make a difference.
Guys, can we get the show started?
Let's do it.
Here we go, sports fans.
Hello, everybody. Welcome into Sports Day Insider. We appreciate you listening and coming back every week. And we're coming back after a week off. We appreciate that. I was on a little vacation. Evan's not with us this week. Evan Grant is traveling today. And so that means that the conversation will be a lot smoother and the camaraderie will be a lot better without Evan's poisoned atmosphere he brings to this podcast. Hi, David Moore. How are you? Speaking of poison.
Yes, that is our gift to you. There is no Evan Grant today. We were thinking, coming off a holiday weekend where we missed last week, regrettably, what can we give our listeners? And we feel this is the perfect gift.
No, Evan.
An Evan-free podcast.
Gosh. Oh, we're being ugly. We don't mean any of that. We're sorry Evan can't be here with us today. But Evan wouldn't have a whole lot to say, I don't think, about the Mavericks and the Clippers in the playoffs. I don't know if I have a whole lot to say about it other than, wow, how did this happen? I mean, who would have predicted any of this? Who would have predicted, first of all, that the Mavericks go out there and handily take a 2-0 lead in Los Angeles, an unbelievable start to this series? Like the one thing that I thought going into that was, this is just unsustainable. They're not going to shoot 50% from 3-point range. You know, anytime you do something that's a little bit outrageous, to me, that's not a good sign. I'd rather they have beaten the Clippers because they played good defense and because they played reasonably well. Otherwise, those are the kind of things that maybe you can sustain. You're not going to keep shooting 50% from three.
No, but you also don't anticipate to come back and go like 5 of 30 from three as a response. And that's the, you are going to have an erosion of that and return to the norm, but that doesn't mean you become completely inefficient, which is what they've done. And, you know, it's not just, I think the other thing that fans and the players have to be very careful they're not emotionally walloped off of this is that it wasn't just that they went up 2-0 by taking, winning two games on the road and then coming back home. It was the fact after being up 2-0, they jumped out to a 30-11 lead at home in game three and quickly frittered that away. And now, you know, momentum has shifted dramatically in this series. And you know, it has a much different feel than it had before. And this always happens on the playoffs, especially on the outside. People probably put too much into momentum, but the Mavericks really are at a crisis point in my mind and going into this game five because it has swung so dramatically over these last 6.5 quarters. And, you know, Dallas finds itself in such a precarious position now as a young team. It needs to reestablish itself early in game five and play a game like it did in the first two of the series, not the way these last two are unfolded. Or I do think this gets away from them very, very quickly.
Yeah, I wonder at this point, you know, how much of this is gotten into their heads. The fact that they were up 2-0 and then playing so well in the first few minutes of game three before they lost twice. You know, in game four, that loss, which was a horrific loss, they just completely fell apart. So yep. Much of that.
They were never in it. I mean, they were chasing the whole game, never in it at home.
Yeah. And a lot of that, obviously, we'd attribute to the fact that Luka Doncic has has got this terrible neck problem. David, I don't know if you ever had a little cervical strain like that. I've had those myself where you can hardly.
I've strained a lot of things. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. At this point in my life, I've strained just about everything. But, you know, that is extremely painful when you can't turn your head like that. And it feels like, you know, sometimes I feel like there's a rod in your neck, and it's just a painful thing to have happen to you. It's just rare that you ever see it from an athlete. I can't think of a handful of times whenever I've seen this has happened to an athlete. And you would think there were things they could do to relax that, to make it where it was. Obviously, they have, in some respects, you know, mitigated it somewhat. But, you know, when you heard from Rick Carlisle after the game, he said it looked to me like he couldn't turn his head to the left.
To the left,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's pretty bad for your point guard not to be able to turn his head to the left.
And think about it as well, just when you have those nerve issues and you know, you have that like stabbing pain or something when you're trying to do something, it kind of grabs at you. It feels like with your passing or your shooting, or you see a play you want to make and then you try to make it in your normal motion and you can't. And so maybe you just flinch a bit and that changes the trajectory of the pass or what you're doing. He clearly was a different player, and that's the only thing you wrestle with, I think, if you're the Mavericks going into game five. It's like, well, yeah, we didn't play as well as we wanted, but our loss in game four was more of a health issue on Luka rather than us just completely falling apart. If he's healthy, we're going to get back to what we were in the first two games, and I'm sure that's what they're going to focus on. But in my mind, they have some strategic issues they have to address here. That's been clear off these last two games with how the Clippers responded. And physically, there are questions about they did not answer physically. I mean, the Clippers came at them in both of those games, and they backed down physically. And they have to be the aggressor offensively and defensively. So there's a lot to fix here. Normally, when a series is 2-2, you kind of go, well, let's focus on this one thing. Strategically, what should we do here? And the Clippers' response was, okay, we're going to go smaller so we can switch all of these pick and rolls and make it more difficult on Dallas. And that worked. But normally you're focused on one thing in a tie series. I think the Mavericks are in a position now where there are a couple things they have to adjust and be concerned about.
You know, this is the thing that you were talking about with the matchups. And of course, going into this series, everybody felt like, well, Kristaps Porzingis is the best big man in this series. He should be able to dominate. And of course, not only has that not happened, he's been terrible. I mean, yeah, in game four,
really
he played a little bit better in game four, terrible in game three, really kind of a non-factor in the first two games. And this has been a kind of an issue all year long. What we're seeing here in this series to me is kind of a microcosm of the Mavericks season. At times they play really well and they look like they're really in sync and everything is going great. And at other times they just seem like they're lost. And that has certainly seemed to be the case for me watching this team play now. They couldn't take advantage of the size advantage of Porzingis down low. And you and I talked about that briefly earlier from the standpoint of that's not really where the NBA is going now. That's not what teams do. They don't pound it down low. The numbers say to shoot from the outside. That's what Porzingis brings you, is that ability to do that. But you know, he doesn't really have to start out down on the blocks. He can start out someplace else. He's good with putting the ball on the floor. He's been very successful at doing that, although they have run guys at him to take the ball away from him, smaller guys at times, and that's been an issue for him as well. But, you know, at some point, and I hate to sound like every Mavericks fan alive, at some point, Porzingis is going to have to live up to the money. I mean, yeah, he's got a big contract, you know, but by the time this thing is over in 23-24, he's going to be making $36 million a year. You don't pay a guy $36 million a year to give you, you know, 15, 16 points and 6 or 7 rebounds or 5 or 6 rebounds a game. He's going to have to do a lot more than that for this team, because Tim Hardaway is kind of regressed here after a great start in the first two games to being more of what I think he really is. I don't think he's better than what he has been in the last two games, but I don't think he's as good as he was in the first two either. You know, he's somewhere in the middle of those two things. So for those things to have, for the Mavericks to have a chance here to at least extend this thing to a game seven, because Charles Barkley says they won't win another game.
Says it's done. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they can get it to game seven. I predicted they would lose in seven. That's going to be very hard to win in Los Angeles in a game seven. That'd be very difficult. Although they won there twice already. I don't know how many times do you expect them to do that, though. I mean, how many times are they going to win three games on the road? That's a lot to ask.
Yeah, their most realistic path to victory in this series is to win the next two games. If they don't win the next two games, I don't see how they win this series. Because going back to L.A. for a game seven, that's just – then at that point, you're really saying, oh, okay, so you win four games in L.A. Now, again, but going back to what you're talking about, Porzingis and also Hardaway – it's what we talked about during the season. Porzingis didn't play enough to really kind of cement what his role was in this offense. And I was just struck, and especially in game three, but even to some extent in game four, just how disconnected he was from the offense. I mean, in game three, when he did get it on the perimeter, he rushed his shot. When he did go in down low, he just seemed totally lost. And the Mavericks didn't really seem comfortable with how to incorporate him into the offense that game either. And then now what they do in the game four, they come out and the Clippers go small. So he goes into the post and they get the ball to him at first two possessions and he scores both times immediately. And you go, well, okay, well, this is, you know, they're getting him involved early, which is good. And they're exploiting the size advantage that they have to make the Clippers pay for this decision. But then what happened is they came down and they continually tried to force the ball into the post. And they're not a good offensive team doing that. You know, they're not a diverse offensive team. I think when you allow them to shoot the threes and move the ball on the perimeter and go with pick and rolls and let Luka probe the defense, they're fine. But if you're talking about coming down in a half-court set, getting the ball into Porzingis or someone else in the low post and running an offense from there, they're not good at that. Most teams in this league aren't good at that anymore. But that was what was required. And so in trying to get Porzingis involved down low, where he normally doesn't like to make a living anyway, they got out of sync offensively, I thought, early in that game. And then they were just tentative the rest of the way, and then you're not making shots. And with Luka not being right physically in that game, it underscored, you know, we've talked a lot about, well, who's the number, who's the number two player behind Luka? Is it Porzingis? Is Hardaway actually elevated himself into that role? You know, because of all the time Porzingis missed late, Hardaway was kind of forced into that role, and you saw him respond. But that doesn't mean he is that player. It means he responded for a short stretch of time. And I think what these last two games have illustrated is after Luka, the Mavericks really don't have an option. They don't have a solid guy that they can turn to when Luka's not at the top of his game offensively. And very quickly, what does that mean? You know, I think coming out of game three, I think the Clippers went, and this sounds counterintuitive, but I think the Clippers went, you know what? We're really fine with Luka scoring 44, 46 points a game if it means the rest of the – if his teammates don't get involved offensively. Because if he scores his 40 to 45, it's a close game late. No one other than Luka has gotten into any sort of offensive rhythm. We can really shut him down in the fourth quarter. And that happened. And I think the Clippers are happy to play that out. I think the rest of this series are going to say, you know what, if Luka goes for a 20-point quarter in the first quarter – great. That means that Porzingis didn't get involved and Hardaway didn't get involved, and these guys are less likely to work themselves into the flow as the game goes along.
So let's take this then, if going forward and the rest of this series, and I agree 100% with you about the fact that they don't have anybody you can count on to be that consistent threat behind.
Consistent is key. Yeah, they've had guys rise up on occasion, but no one you can say, Luka's off tonight, okay, Porzingis is the guy. You can't say that, and you can't say that about Hardaway either.
And of course, he's been paid like that, Porzingis is, and so is Hardaway, for that matter. He's making over $20 million a year. So let's look at it this way going forward. After this season's over, if this playoff is over after seven games or after one round again, Who's back on this team? Is Josh Richardson back? He'll be a free agent.
Yeah, I don't think he's given them what they anticipated. I don't think he's been the – he's a nice defender, but I don't know that he's done enough offensively and found a niche for himself in this offense where that is something you're necessarily going to move forward with. You do need athleticism on the perimeter, and he gives you that. But I don't think he's had the impact they had hoped or anticipated that he would.
No, not at all. I say no to that. Now, Tim Hardaway is going to cost you probably $20 million again or more. Is he back?
Well, now you get in the issue. If you let Richardson go, and then can you let another perimeter player in Hardaway go, who arguably has been your second most efficient offensive player after Luka? If you do that, you have to have an upgrade in place, in my mind, or feel you're going to get one in free agency. You have to be certain that can happen. I think Hardaway to me is a guy that I think you probably need to bring back. He can start. He can come off the bench. While he would prefer to start, and I think temperamentally that's what he wants to do, he's still willing to work within the team framework. I don't know that you have enough talent that you can afford to let Hardaway go.
Yeah, the issue with that is, of course, you can't roll up a big max contract for anybody else. If you do,
and
you're talking
one.
About putting pieces together again, and that's been a struggle for the Mavericks as they develop here. So we'll have to see what happens, because unless they could find a taker on Porzingis' contract, he's going to be here for several years. And I didn't think that was ever a bad idea, but now I'm starting to have some second thoughts about that. All right, so that's our Mavericks talk today. Now we're going to shift over to a little bit of potpourri again. We're going to have several things we want to talk about. We're going to talk about the Cowboys. We're going to talk about the Rangers. And we're going to do a little bit about Jordan Spieth, because it's that time of the year when Jordan Spieth is making a run here and there, and certainly did at Colonial last week. So David, let's start off with the Cowboys though, and give us a little update on the offseason workouts.
Well, I think from the outside observation, what everyone wanted to know was, how does Dak Prescott look? How is he moving around coming off of that significant, gruesome injury that he suffered in week five of last October? And the reports there are good. He moved well. You know, you watch him after a play is over. There's no discernible gait or limp. He appeared to be walking fine after the play was done. You know, there were good hit. The velocity on his passes looked good, which is an indication that he's able to plant the foot and set up the way that he wants. So to see that was positive, but I don't think you should read too much into it at this point either, other than, you know, everyone says he's a little ahead of target where you would expect him to be at this phase. And that is good, but I don't, and I know he said, look, I think I could play a game today if I had a week to prepare for a game. I think that's a little too soon. I don't know that we've seen enough to say that. Because, you know, what we see in these drills, they're not moving at full speed. The defense isn't coming at him at full speed, and certainly not with any intent to hit him or drive him into the turf. He's not forcing his ankle or his body to do something that would be unnatural to respond to make a play in these situations that you would in more competitive situations. So it's a very controlled situation, but his movement did look good. I thought at times when he went back, I thought it seemed to me he had happy feet a little bit, that he was shuffling his feet more before planting them and then delivering the ball, which I think is just something to look for going forward. But like I said, he had good velocity on his ball. But in these settings too, where it's not truly competitive, you know, if you're not planting that right foot, and it was the right ankle and that was devastated in that injury, you know, you're compensating. You can compensate with your hip turn, with your arm. And those, if you do that, that manifests itself over time and you can create some other issues. It's hard to tell that in what we saw, because again, it wasn't a fully competitive situation, but he did move well. He looked good, and it was encouraging.
So do you look at this as a situation where fans looking at Dak Prescott over his development in the last 4 years, a guy that, well, if he's not running the ball, you know, he's not going to be as effective for you. This is where the NFL is going anyway, and this is what he does best. He needs to be running more often. Are you more concerned about his ability to take off and run when he needs to, or about his ability to stand, drive off that right ankle and make the throws he has to make?
Yeah, we'll see as it goes along. I don't think he's, you know, he's always, we've talked about this, whether or not he should run more. He's very judicious in his running opportunities. He doesn't look to run first. It's really his third or fourth option most times, except when he's in the red zone. And then to me, that's where he exposes himself to some pretty significant hits. But I think he's still, you know, once he gets outside the pocket, I think running's still going to be an option for him. But when you look at how he plays and what this offense is and what the strengths are with the receivers, I really look more at dropping back in the pocket, planting that foot, and delivering those throws with good velocity. I think that's going to say more about where he is and his comeback and how quickly he gets back to the level that he was versus his running ability.
Yeah, and of course, there's always the mental aspect of all this too.
Sure.
It's like, how does a guy respond to this kind of injury? Is he a little bit iffy? Does he feel like, I don't want to expose myself to that again? These are always issues with athletes when they suffer these kind of injuries, how they respond, not just physically, but how they respond mentally to it. So tell us what the schedule is for the offseason workouts at this point.
Yeah, they're back at today at the Star. They resumed organized team activities this phase of the offseason program. They'll have three practices this week. We get to see one of them. We'll see the one on Thursday. And then next week is the only mandatory aspect of the off-season program, which is the mini camp. It's the mandatory mini camp. It really doesn't impact Dallas. I mean, most of their players are there. And the ones that we didn't see last week when we were there had been there the previous day and came the day afterwards, as far as my understanding, like Ezekiel Elliott and some of the other players. So that will be a three-day session in the middle of next week. And then that will be it until they report to training camp in late July, that third week in July. And all indications are that, while not announced yet, all indications are they will be returning to Oxnard for training camp.
So let me ask you this about Dak then. Obviously, he's going to need a lot more rehab, a lot more work. He lives here in the Dallas area. So
continue to go to the facility. Yeah, he'll continue to go up to the Star. That's where he's been doing most of his rehab. There may be a week or two period there where he's not here that he's out, but he will still have, especially at his salary now, he can afford to have a person with him and be around whatever rehab that he needs to take place.
Okay. All right. So that's good to know that Dak is working his way back here, and we'll see how that goes going forward. Last week at the Colonial, Jordan Spieth, Dallas's own, out of Jesuit and the University of Texas, made a run there at Colonial. Of course, he's already won there once and was in position to do so going into Sunday. He was leading by one over Jason Kokrak. And at that point, he wasn't able to hold on to that. And we saw a little bit of what Jordan does is get himself in trouble and then get himself out. I've made this comparison, David, and I think you made a nice correction on it. He reminds me of Phil Mickelson. You know, you watch him just to see what's going to happen. The difference being that Phil Mickelson gets himself in bad situations because he does crazy things, because he has that gambler's instinct literally. We know that that Phil's got a lot of money on whatever he's doing, probably, and he's willing to try things. It's not so much that Jordan is gambling so much, although he will occasionally do that because he believes in himself so much. But he will just he struggles so much off the tee that he has to scramble so much. I think that to me, I guess that goes one of two ways. It just feels like you're constantly putting pressure on yourself to extricate yourself from the mess that you just put yourself in. I guess the flip side of that is, well, I've done it before, I can do it again. That maybe it gives you confidence to do that.
Yeah, and I guess another thing about scrambling too is you really force yourself into more decisions, right? And because you're when you're not in the fairway just hitting 140 in or 110 in, when you're in the rough, when you have a bad lie, when you have this to account for, you have to take more into account. So there's more that goes into your decision making. But yeah, usually it's him poor shots. It's not poor decisions. It's poor shots. And he did it again. I mean, he really struggled. I mean, it was and it was from the start. I mean, he bogeyed 2, 3, and 4. You come into the final day with a lead and you give it away within the first four holes. Well, you've established a completely different tone. And then the rest of the day was just a grind. And Jason Kokrak wasn't playing that well either. I mean, he shot even par. But you just never got – it was like Spieth was struggling against himself all day. And that's still the question. And I know, look, you know, Tiger took this to a different – standpoint where when he went into day four with a lead, I think I just saw the other day he won like 55 out of 59 times when he took a lead into the fourth round.
Always better protecting a lead. Yes.
Yeah. You know, Spieth is right around 50%. So it's and you say, well, that's a big drop off, but you know, I think McIlroy's around there. Most good players other than Tiger are around that 50%. But you still get the sense this year that while Jordan Spieth has worked his game back into position to be in contention in day four, that he's still not quite ready to close the deal in day four. That it's still going to be a wild ride. It's not, you know, rather than bogeying 2, 3, and 4, he's more likely to do that in day four with a lead than he is to go in there and birdie 2, 3, and 4 and then change the complexion of the rest of the day. So he's gotten back up to that step where he's right there. But as far as competing in the U.S. Open, which is going to be 2 weeks away, I'm not sure that he's there yet where you get the sense that, well, if Spieth is there on day four, he's going to be hard to beat. I don't think he's back to that point yet.
No, I don't think so either. But I will say this. He's at least at a standpoint where he's competitive.
You know,
he went almost four years without being competitive.
Exactly. No, these were big steps this year, but I don't know that it's the step back to where he was winning the majors like he was before. I don't know if his game's refined to that point yet.
Yeah, I think he's probably a year away from that. But at least he is putting himself in that position, and that's good to see. It's good to think that you're not washed up at 26, right? No?
Yeah,
like me and you, we were washed up at
24.
Yeah, we might have been washed up at 24, and that's been a long time. I've just been floating around in the wilderness, 40 years of it. So let's shift now. We've talked about the Cowboys and Jordan Spieth, and obviously the Mavericks. Let's also talk about now the Rangers, who have kind of gone into free fall again. We've seen them do this a couple of times this year. I'm not as concerned about that as this is what we thought they would be. Predicted, I think Evan and I both 70 wins this year, so they're on track for that kind of a performance. We thought it for a little while there they might work themselves up to a 500 team. I don't think that's really possible now. It doesn't look like it anyway from the way they're playing. But the revelation of this season for the Rangers has been Adolis Garcia, who is I know we've talked about him and he's blown me away about how he plays, and I guess what kind of blows me away mostly is that why did people take him so for granted before? Why did the Cardinals give up on him so quickly? Why did the Rangers, for that matter, give up on him so quickly? It went into this season. He was their best hitter in training camp. And I realize that we don't want to rely too much on those numbers, but He had the background of playing very well in Cuba. He had the background of playing very well in two minor league seasons with the Cardinals. He's a guy with plus arm, plus speed in center field. I think he's second in the league now in defensive runs saved as a center fielder. Yes, the question is, can he sustain this? You know, well, what we have seen is that he has one of the best barrel rates in baseball. That he puts every ball. At one point, Sam Bloom had this stat last week. At one point, every ball he put in play except one had, I believe, a off of velocity was over 90 miles per hour. Wow. He consistently makes hard contact with the ball. So he's on a pace now to hit 40 home runs, 40 to 45 home runs. If he does that, he's a superstar. He's Mike Trout material. He's Mike Trout and actually with a better arm in center field. He's not going to hit for average as much, but he's still a terrific hitter. Let's say he doesn't hit 45 home runs going forward. Let's say that's he falls back from that. That's not sustainable. Let's say he hits 25 home runs. With the kind of defense he plays, that's a big-time center fielder. To get a center fielder who can run like he does, throw like he does, and then also have that kind of power. So going forward, unless he completely falls apart, he looks like the Rangers' answer in center field, which is what this team has needed for a long time, obviously. They've had very few answers in center field. They kept trying Leody Taveras last year and this year. I think that and Eli White as well. I don't know what's going to happen with Joey Gallo in right field. I don't know if they decide not to re-sign Joey after next year and he ends up leaving, that Adolis is still playing well, then he could shift over to right field. But in my mind, he plays center field so well. Why would you move him? It's easier to find a right fielder than it is to find a center fielder. So first of all, David, I want to get your thoughts on Garcia and what you think is going to happen with him going forward. And then secondly, I want to talk about Joey Gallo, to have the Rangers put themselves in a position where now, because he's not playing very well, has he come back into their ballpark as far as a contract to extend him?
Yeah. I'm going to throw you a curve and package them together. I think that the way Adolis has played here, it is what you had hoped you would see or establish for a longer period with Gallo. I think you envisioned, that going through all this pain of the last few years, what have we constantly talked about? You want to find some players you can go forward with coming out of this stretch. Right. And you have to, otherwise it's just a stretch in the desert that's been wasted. And a lot of that hope for years was placed on Gallo. Well, now it shifted and you go, well, maybe Gallo's not this guy, but if Adolis is, then we can move on from Gallo and let's start. Then let's see how this thing looks. You're right. I think the Rangers went into this season figuring that the odds are we're not going to be able to keep Joey Gallo. And you can argue that while his performance has brought him back to maybe now he would be more inclined to do it. Has hitting in this ballpark gotten into his head? Is it such an issue that now he wants to go because he's convinced that this is not, or he's not convinced this is the right ballpark for him going forward? Does he kind of want a fresh start now? So I think this is now that the question is, if you know you're going to move on from him, what can you get from him before the trade deadline? And doesn't he need to pick it up here in order for you to get closer to a deal that you would be comfortable taking? So to me, it's not, I think we've kind of moved into the stage where it's not, is Gallo going to be part of the Rangers going forward? It's going to be, what can you get for him before the trade deadline? And can he play well enough here over these next few weeks to generate and spark some deals that make sense for you?
You'd have to be dumping Joey at this point because I don't think he's going to be able to rebound that way. And that'd be interesting to see. I think they're going to end up just playing it out with Joey. They're going to want to see what he does this year and next year. It'll be interesting to see, but you're right. I think it's taken some of the pressure off him because Adolis has played so well in center field. You couldn't imagine getting that kind of performance from a center fielder, much less a center fielder you acquired for nothing. So that has been the one big bright spot of this season for the Rangers so far. And I'm going to tell you something, there hasn't been a lot. There have just been a few. And then he has certainly been that. He's been a lot of fun to watch.
He has been.
Night after night. All right, that's going to do it for our podcast this week. We talked about the Cowboys. We talked about the Rangers. We talked about the Mavericks and the fact that they are now 2-2 in a series where they were up 2-0 coming back home and everybody was ready for a parade. Right, David? I guess not.
We've seen that before. We've had the parade talk here before.
We've had the parade talk before. And they can't blame that on me this time. I did not say anything about a parade. I was on vacation. So anyway, I'm not taking the blame for that. So from everybody in here to everybody out here, that's going to do it. We appreciate it. We'll see you next time. Well, that wraps up another episode of Sports Day Insider.
Is it over already?
Well, Evan, all good things come to an end, I suppose.
The show is produced by Jeff Whittington
and presented by the Dallas Morning News.
Our theme song is by Dallas's own John Dufalo.
Don't forget to follow the Dallas Morning News wherever you get your quality podcasts.
You'll never miss a Sports Day Insider episode, and you'll discover some other great shows.
And if you liked what you heard, please rate the Dallas Morning News feed and give us a review. It helps us reach other sports fans and news junkies.
Learn more about this show and other shows at dallasnews.com/listen.
You'll also find special Dallas Morning News subscription rates just for listeners.
Thanks again for listening.
We'll see you back here next week.